If you have a Bible with you, you may care to have open Luke chapter 16. We continue our studies in the Gospel of Luke, one chapter per week, not being exhaustive, but looking in summary and then concentrating on one part of the chapter. The thing to notice about this chapter is that it flows directly on from the previous chapter. Remember that when Luke wrote this, he didn't write chapter 16. He also said to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him, and this man was wasting his possessions. Verse 2, and so on. The chapter and verse divisions of the scriptures were added hundreds of years after these were written. And so there is nothing special, there is nothing infallible about the chapter and verse divisions, and sometimes you wish that you could go back and beat around the head the person that did the chapter and verse divisions, because sometimes he completely messes up the thought that is being expressed in a particular passage by saying, and here's the end of the verse, now a new one starts, or here's the end of the chapter, now we start a new one, and it can get very confusing. So just imagine out of it the number 16 and indeed the verse numbers, and just concentrate on the words. And it's the master volume you want to turn down slightly. Is that better? That's a bit better. And everybody can still hear. Yes. So what we read here continues on straight from the previous chapter. And so Jesus, having been speaking about the Pharisees' wrong response to the arrival of sinners, instead of saying, here are sinners repenting, this is wonderful, they were begrudging them and saying, well, what are they doing here? They shouldn't be allowed in here. And so Jesus, we're told, told them this parable, and we either have one parable with three parts, or three parables, the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son. And when Jesus finishes relating the story of the lost son, what does he then do? Is this another day? Is this another place? No, we're told he also said to his disciples. So as well as telling the parable, he also told them this. So this is the same place, and this is the same date. The same people are present. They haven't heard the parable of the lost son and suddenly said, right, that's it, we're going. But Jesus now also says specifically to his disciples, though it's probable that everybody else present heard it as well, but this was directed to his disciples. It's all the same context. And he tells them about this steward. This steward who was dishonest. Sorry, the word in this translation is manager, but most other translations translate it steward. Of course, as time goes by, most people don't understand what a steward is, but they do understand what a manager is. And a steward is someone who manages something on behalf of someone else. And so manager is probably a term that is more familiar to people and more understandable. So here is this manager, and I will try and use that word all the way through. Here is this manager who is not very good, but he's dishonest. And so Jesus talks about his shrewdness and how we should learn from such shrewdness. He speaks about faithfulness. Are you faithful or not? Doesn't matter how much you have that you need to be faithful about. But are you faithful? Because you should be faithful to one thing. He comes back and talks about the Pharisees. Now remember, the Pharisees are present. But he's talking about the Pharisees. Pharisees, lovers of money, heard all these things. They ridiculed him. Jesus saying, money is not important. What is important is how you use the money. And the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, said, this is ridiculous. They mocked. Because they thought money in and of itself was the important thing. And you'll be very familiar with that verse when Paul wrote to Timothy saying, the love of money is the root of all evil. Notice, by the way, just as a quick aside, notice Paul does not say money is the root of all evil. He says the love of money is the root of all evil. And some translations, the one that Gordon's using, for example, the New International Version, says the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And I'm sure the translators were not throwing in those extra words just for the fun of it. I'm sure they thought that there was justification from the original text. But here are the Pharisees, they love money. And while they prepare to give some money into the temple coffers, they don't give much. They give a little, which might seem a lot to some people. If Bill Gates were here today, Bill Gates, richest man in the world, and he put £100,000 into the box at the back, we'd say, wow, what a huge amount of money! Bill Gates would think, well, it's just loose change. When you're worth $50 billion, what's $100,000? Peanuts. So it was with the Pharisees. The Pharisees had huge wealth, and they put in what to most people was a huge amount of money, but for them it was nothing, because they wanted to keep hold of most of it while giving a good impression. And so Jesus points out that the fact that they claim to keep the law is irrelevant, because they don't really keep the law at all. What they're doing is a travesty. And he then gives this specific example: everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. Because the Pharisees believed that if after 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 years, 30 years, you got sick of your wife, perhaps you thought, well, she's getting a bit old and frail now, I'll trade her in for a more recent model, and they'd write out a certificate of divorce. I divorce my wife, give it to her, that's it, and you can go and marry someone else. And that was the attitude of the Pharisees towards marriage. And you wonder, where did love come into this? If you really love someone, then however old and decrepit they are, you don't want to get rid of them. Well, that seems to be what the Pharisees were doing. And they go off and get the more recent model. And Jesus, still speaking in the context of the Pharisees who love money and despise sinners, then told this story about the rich man and Lazarus. Now we need to say a few words here about parables. We're not told that this story of the rich man and Lazarus is a parable. Jesus just relates it. There was a rich man. But if you want to call it a parable, that's fine by me. But you will meet people come round your doors, and when you mention that people either go to heaven or hell, they will start saying all sorts of strange things. They will say, well, hell is just the grave, nothing more. They'll tell you that if you go to Suffolk and you talk to farmers and talk to them about planting potatoes, that what they are doing is helling. Planting potatoes they call helling. Clearly, they say, hell is going into the ground. Well, this is really nonsense. You don't go and grab a Suffolk farmer and ask him, what he means when he uses certain words, and to say, therefore, that's what the Bible means, because a farmer from Suffolk had nothing to do with writing the Bible. You've got to ask the people who wrote the Bible what they mean by the words that they use. So another tactic that is used is to say, ah, well, you say it's a parable. Yes. And? Well, therefore, what Jesus is describing, it's not literal. It's just a story. It's nothing more than that. Just a story. There's no reality behind this at all. And they seem to be very satisfied by saying that. But all you need to do is just look at the previous chapter. What man of you having 100 sheep? Well, are there people who have 100 sheep? No, this is a parable, so that's fiction. Here's one sheep, wanders off, and the shepherd goes and looks for it. No, there couldn't ever be a sheep that does that. No, a shepherd would never care for a sheep like that. No, this is fiction. And we could go through and say of every point in each parable, are these things fiction? The answer is no. While there might not be a specific shepherd Jesus had in mind, this is how shepherds behaved, and this is how sheep behaved. While Jesus may not have had in mind a specific woman, there are women who would behave like this when they lost a coin. And while Jesus may not have been thinking about a particular family, there are families where a son takes his inheritance and goes off and loses it all in riotous living, but comes to his senses and comes home and asks for the forgiveness of his father and is received with great joy. So by saying it's a parable, it does nothing. It doesn't say that when people die, they don't either go to Abraham's side or to this place of torment in Hades. That's what these people are trying to tell you, but it doesn't work. Jesus is talking about two people who may well have been fictitious, but their experiences are the experiences of many. That you either go one way or you go the other. You are either in bliss or you are in torment. That in each case you have continued existence, but that continued existence may be one of joy, bliss and happiness, or it may be one of torment and distress. And I think we have to say that the rich man here, Jesus is speaking about Pharisees. The Pharisees were lovers of money. And so Jesus is picking up on things that they love, things that they do that are wrong, and here he is emphasizing to them the great folly and the great danger of loving anything else in this world before God. The Pharisees jumped up and down and said, yes, we love God. Well then, where is the evidence that you love God? Oh, but we do, we're very religious. Well, what does that mean? You mean you stand on street corners praying so that everybody can see you? Well, you're not loving God, you're loving yourself. And you're wanting other people to love you. You want other people to see you standing there praying, so other people will say, you are wonderful. That's not loving God, that's loving yourself. And the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, yes, they were happy to give some money away, but they wanted to keep most of it for themselves. And they gave money to charity, not because they were concerned about people, not because they were concerned about showing the love of God towards people, but in order that people would think well of them. When they fasted twice a week, they were not fasting as a spiritual discipline in order that they could give themselves to prayer and concentrate upon God, and were so taken up with prayer that they haven't got time for food. No, what they did was to go without food, and they would distort their faces and they'd say, "Oh, I'm so hungry." And people would say, "Well, why don't you get something to eat?" "Oh, I can't eat today because I'm fasting." And people would say, "Oh, what a holy man this is." But they weren't fasting in order to get closer to God. They were fasting in order that people could see their agonized faces as they pulled on their bellies. And so that people would say, "What a holy man this is." They wanted the praise of men. They weren't concerned about God. They spoke a lot about God. And they got very irate. They got so irate with Jesus they killed him when they were exposed for what they really were. But Jesus points out it's not a question of the truth being revealed in this life. Jesus is making the point that there is a life to come. You have two men, a rich man who loved money, and you had a poor man who had nothing. And the poor man suffered greatly in this world, but he didn't complain, and he was quite content. He would have loved to have had more if he could, but he didn't love that which he hadn't got. Whereas the rich man loved what he had got. So no love for God at all. If he loved God, he would show compassion upon Lazarus. And so we get the situation. Death comes to both. But then a great divide occurs. Lazarus goes one way to everlasting bliss. The rich man goes the other way to everlasting torment. And is horrified, the rich man, to discover what's happened to him. "Oh, I'm in agony. Please send Lazarus to cool my tongue." Abraham tells him, "Sorry, can't be done. There's a great gulf between here and there. There is no connection between the two. It's not possible. There is a great chasm between us that has been fixed to prevent passage from one to the other." So the man, now horrified at what has happened to him, possibly for the first time in his life, has compassion upon others and realizes he has five brothers. "Send Lazarus to my five brothers to warn them." Now, is this because he showed love to his brothers? Well, it's possible. He was concerned that his brothers might not experience what he's experiencing. But it might also be that he's horrified at the thought of what he's suffering, and he's thinking of the bad influence that he has been upon his brothers, and his brothers are following his example, and he realizes that if they come there as well, he will be held responsible for the influence that he has had upon his brothers, and he doesn't want to carry that responsibility. Speaking about responsibility, that goes back to what Jesus says at the beginning of the chapter. This manager who was irresponsible in the way he managed this rich man's estate and gets thrown out, but by a bit of shrewdness he manages to find a way of surviving after he loses his job. Perhaps the rich man here, in his torment, is thinking, "How can I avoid the responsibility that I have for the influence I've had upon my brothers?" And it is an awesome thing to consider the influence that we are upon other people. The things that we do, the things that we say, the things that we write, all these things are an influence upon others. Are they an influence for good or ill? In the way in which we live, are people going to watch us and say, well, they're religious people and they live in an ungodly way, so clearly it's all right to be ungodly? We need to be very careful in all that we do, because all that we do is observed by someone, and it will be an influence upon them. And we need to be sure that the influence that we have upon them is an influence for good, an influence for the gospel. We need especially to be careful when speaking to people about the gospel that we never give them the impression that there is any other way for them to find forgiveness of sins and a safe road to heaven apart from Christ. Because there is no other way. And if we care for people, if we have compassion for people, we have to direct them to Christ alone and not let them think that by being, as they would describe themselves, a good person, that that is good enough. It is not, it never has been, and it never will be. We have a responsibility for those around us who observe us. But he says, being concerned about this, please send Lazarus to my brothers to warn them of this place. And Abraham replies, they have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them. Now, when Jesus was talking, there wasn't a New Testament. There was only the Old Testament. But now there is the whole Bible. So we could rephrase what Abraham says here and say, they have the Bible. If they won't listen to what God says in the Bible, what can be done? And so therefore it is vitally important that we make the scriptures available to everyone. Now in this country, the vast majority can read. The vast majority can go into a bookshop and they can have a choice of hundreds of different translations of the scriptures into English. Some old, some modern. If people want to know what God says, all they've got to do is pick up a Bible. We give Bibles to people in the hope that they will read them. But if they don't read them, if they don't listen to what the Bible says, then the responsibility is upon their heads for what happens to them in the future. But you get some people today who say, but that's not enough. Getting people to read the Bible is not enough. Preaching is not enough. Speaking to people one-to-one is not enough. If people are going to be persuaded, what we need is a sign from heaven. Then they will believe. So what we need is to have people speaking in tongues. We need to have people prophesy. That is God speaking directly through someone. What we need are miracles of healing. And you can go along to some meetings and they will claim that all these things and more happen. Just a few years ago, people were claiming that God was giving them gold teeth. It was a fiction, of course. But this is what they were claiming. They were claiming all sorts of wonders and signs, but none of them stand up to investigation. We've looked at this before, so I won't deal with it now. Let's say we need signs in order for people to believe. Abraham said, they have Moses and the prophets, they have the Bible, let them hear them. And the rich man says, no, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent. And that is the mentality of so many. If we have miracles, especially if someone rises from the dead, then people will listen. Then people will believe. Abraham said to him, if they will not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced if someone should rise from the dead. The problem is not a lack of miracles. The problem is not listening to what God has said in the Bible. That is the problem. That was the problem of the Pharisees. The Pharisees knew the Bible from cover to cover, but they didn't pay any attention to what it said. They used their ability to quote large chunks of the Bible to get people to speak well of them and to be thought the most religious people in the world. But all it did was to confirm their condemnation because they did not obey what God had said. And this, of course, this whole chapter is a lesson to all of us. What use do we make of all that God has given to us? Are we faithful in the things that God has given to us? We have Bibles aplenty. Do we read them and take notice of what they say? Does it affect our thinking? Does it affect our living? Does it affect our speech? Do people observe us and say, there is someone who believes the Bible and seeks to practice it? Because come the day of judgment, we will be examined and judged on the basis of how faithful we have been with the truth that God has given us, with the gifts that God has given us, with the life that God has given us. God will not ask you, were you a multimillionaire? God will ask you, were you faithful with what I gave you? What did you do with what I gave you? Did you receive the truth? Did you believe the truth? Did you live in accordance with the truth? But the other thing to consider is, what is it that is our greatest desire? What is it that we love most of all? Are we like the Pharisees? We're lovers of money, or lovers of things, or primarily are we lovers of God? If we're lovers of God, then God will receive us. If we're lovers of God, then whether we have much or little is not of primary concern to us. If we have much, then we will use it wisely, not for our own self-aggrandizement, but for the good of others, for the spread of the gospel, and for the glory of God. It's interesting to look around and discover the number of charitable trusts that there are, and how many of these trusts were set up by believers over the last few hundred years. Some of these people who set up these trusts were immensely wealthy. There was a lady. She was a lady, so she was married to a lord, and when he died, she inherited all his wealth, and she made use of it. Her name was the Countess of Huntingdon, Selena. And she became a Christian. And she heard George Whitfield, and she made George Whitfield one of her chaplains. And with all her vast wealth, she built chapels all over the country for Whitfield and for like-minded men to preach in. There's a painting of her that hangs in the museum of Bethesda Home for Boys, an orphanage founded by George Whitfield in Georgia, in America. And it's a very interesting painting because it shows her attitude. She's standing, holding in her hand a crown of thorns. And she has her foot resting on her coronet. Here is a woman of immense wealth. She loves the crown of thorns associating her with Christ far more than the wealth and the status that her coronet brought her. She is but one example among many of believers of the past who were immensely wealthy but were concerned more with doing good for people with the wealth that they had. And I hope that on the day of judgment they will be found to have been faithful in that which God gave them. But, you say, we don't have vast wealth, so what can we do? Well, what we can do is to be faithful with that which God has given us. Some of us have little money, but we have gifts that God has given us. Some of us can speak. So do we speak to persuade people of the truth of the gospel? Some of us are more compassionate than others. Well, do we show that compassion? In the things that God has given us, are we faithfully using them in the way in which we should? And in so doing, are we ready for that great day on which we will be held to account for what God has given us? And will we find ourselves in eternity being on the same side as Lazarus, or on the same side as the rich man? It's all dependent upon what we believe and subsequently practice in this life.